Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Thank you. you, should I be moving?
Gotta wait, brother man, gotta wait.
Gotta move on, I gotta see tomorrow. Gotta move on, gotta get ahead. I can't look back, there's nothing there but sorrow. Gotta move on and get ahead.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully, to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, July 14th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our sixth study session on Gil Scott Heron's memoir, The Last Holiday. Picking up on chapter 30, this is our second to last session. So next week, all done. If you want to be thinking of concluding thoughts, takeaways, major themes from the book, you should be thinking of those to share this week, next week. All done. Pushing forward to our next book. The song you heard at the beginning today, The Summer of 42, as I said, Mr. Heron has such a massive catalog of music and songs and everything. You know, it's no way we would even be able to play a smidgen of his catalog. We've only heard a few songs, but The Summer of 42, for people who are being exposed and hearing new tunes of his for the first time. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. We're going to start to get more information about him working with Stevie Wonder and the work that they did to establish the King Holiday. Context of white supremacy, Gil Scott Heron, The Last Holiday, a memoir, audio segment number one. 30. I saw Stevie Wonder with Barbara Walters on 2020, one August night in 1980. Seeing Stevie on that show made me realize he was braver than I would ever be again without the TV equivalent of a prenuptial agreement. I'd been double-crossed too many times. So there I was, watching Stevie go one-on-one with the queen bee of beating people up. I didn't doubt Stevie's ability to represent himself, but TV ratings are not based on making subjects look good. They don't even have to make you look like you. They have to make an audience look. But it's hard to make Stevie look bad. He is as clever with his vocabulary as he is versatile with his keyboards. He was adept at saying what he thought about your line of questioning if it was out of order, always maintaining that smile of his. I nodded at the screen as he played a few chords of Happy Birthday on the piano with a smile. The news was that Stevie was going on tour in October with Bob Marley and would be promoting his new LP, Hotter Than July. He was also planning a rally in Washington, D.C. in January 1981 to bring attention to the question of a national holiday honoring Dr. King. Happy birthday. I watched Barbara Walters because Stevie couldn't. With the half glasses sitting on her nose like an acrobat on a seesaw, reading glasses that she used to read Stevie while she scanned her notebook. I knew the announcement of the tour meant that Stevie would be coming to D.C., and I knew that when they got there, I would have a ticket. It didn't work out that way. What I mean is, I got to the Washington concert, but I didn't have to pay. And that was also something that I could not have predicted. I didn't find out I'd get in through the stage door until November. A few days after I saw Stevie's interview with Barbara Walters, and I told myself that I wanted to see his show, I got a call from an old New York friend named Clive Wasson. I didn't know what kind of work Clive was doing, but I could almost hear the L.A. in his voice. It was a pleasant conversation. We had some people that we both knew and spent a few minutes going over their current situations before Clive got down to business. He was working for the folks who were promoting Stevie's tour with Bob Marley. The problem was that Bob was on the tour with the Commodores and was playing in the next few weeks in the same cities Stevie would do in early November, and just where would the Midnight Band be in early November? I had spent the better part of 5 years getting people familiar with the Midnight Band on stage and on 3 albums. But now the name had indeed established some recognition, even among promoters. There was no Midnight Band. We had reformed and added women to our songs on Secrets in 1978, and then took those women vocalists on the road. After less than a year, we'd cut back to a quintet we'd called A Mere Facade, but the West Coast representative of our record label came to me in Denver one night and said, "Who are these Arab dudes you're playing with? Who's A Mere Facade?" After I got up off the floor from laughing, I needed another name change because the potential for phonic distortion was obviously more extensive than I could overcome. People continued to refer to whoever I brought with me as the Midnight Band, but Brian's departure in March 1980 had erased the last trace of Midnight from my music. At that point, I had reconnected with Carl Cornwell, the Play Anything wizard I had known since my days at college, and we reconfigured the rhythm section and added horns. The band we organized had a totally new sound, and I called it the Amnesia Express. From mid-April through early July, I had been on tour with the new group and then recorded an album scheduled for release in late November. All I had in my calendar for November was a gig in Atlanta and a solo show at Kent State University. I figured I'd play a few gigs before Christmas so the guys could all play Santa Claus, but what Clive was proposing wouldn't interfere with any of that. "I'd be glad to be employed for a couple of weeks," I told Clive. I gave Clive the number for my agent in New York to discuss the dates Stevie had on tap for his first 2 weeks. As far as I was concerned, I was looking at found money. It was looking like our folks would have a happy Thanksgiving and we could work on a Merry Christmas later. Things were looking up. 31. Show business is just like any other business in certain respects. Of course, people in show business have a visibility that paints a larger-than-life aura around them. Their work in music, movies, or some facet of entertainment makes them a part of people's lives. They are so well known in the corners of everywhere that it feels as though they've lived more than one lifetime. The fact that certain aspects of the arts endure beyond the span of normal expectations makes them part of generations born after their contributions were completed. The exploits and exploitation of the arts make individuals with no more talent than a turnip famous for ages. The stories their lives inspire give them reputations that inspire continued repetition. There are heroes and zeros. There are people of sincere and genuine talent and others who couldn't do wrong right. Just like, I imagine, every other walk of life. You meet some people that you wish like hell you never had, and others who make such an impression on you that you feel convinced you made the right career choice. You meet some people you are proud to call your friends, and others who are so crooked that when they die, you're sure they'll be screwed into the ground. The influence these people have on your life depends on when you meet them. I will always believe that you need to meet good people, talented and generous people, in order to later withstand the bitter disappointments that destroy the careers of so many talented people. I started at the top when it came to wonderful, talented, and generous people. During my first week of publicity for The Vulture and my book of poetry, I was a guest on a New York radio program hosted by Mr. Ozzie Davis and Miss Ruby Dee. And in all honesty, I don't remember a word I said, if I said anything, because they also had John Killens and John Williams on, the two brothers who were both great black novelists, and I think I just sat there in the studio with my mouth hanging open. I doubted if Ozzie and Ruby remembered me from that. Apparently, though, they had kept up with me prior to our first gig on the Hotter Than July tour, which kicked off in Houston the last week of October 1980, they invited me to do a TV show they now had on Houston's PBS channel. The Ozzie and Ruby show was action-packed, and we could thank PBS for that. Before there was cable TV and umpteen hundred channels, PBS stations were primarily broadcast on VHF, and their programs were on one of the four or five lines in your daily TV guide in the paper. That way, even though their primetime programs were sometimes buried under an avalanche of promotion that the networks gave their shows, there was more of a possibility to notice what they were offering. One of the shows I religiously tried to catch was Ozzie and Ruby, because there would be certain sections of the show featuring the co-hosts doing a reading or comic skit that showed real versatility and talent. The day before we taped the show, I checked into our hotel about midday and arrived at the studio in plenty of time for the roundtable production meeting where I found out what we were doing. I knew the band would enjoy it. There were songs we played on most shows like Winter in America and Storm Music, along with a couple of songs we had never performed on a show, most notably Jose Campos Torres and Vernon James' composition, Morning Thoughts. I felt as though the staff had done a great job because they had packed 28 minutes of our songs and poems to put into a 30-minute show. I didn't raise one objection or have anything to add. I sat through the meeting nodding at them like a bobblehead doll. The biggest rush was that I felt as if I was sitting with royalty. It was like the feeling I had when I met Quincy Jones or Sidney Poitier. I knew there would be excerpts from the show that people would see, but I wished folks could see me just sitting there having a meeting with Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee like I belonged there. It was terrific. Everybody appreciates movie stars and music icons, even people who share their profession. We are all fans marveling at their mastery over their medium and fascinated by their fame. By the time I went to Houston, I had met Clive Davis, Miles Davis, and Ozzie Davis and was knocked out for a minute by each one. By the time I got back to the hotel, I felt ready for half of a Texas meal. I understood that a whole Texas meal was an entire steer and that I would probably have to cook it myself. While I didn't see a sign in the room that said no hot plates or bonfires allowed, I had no one in mind who might want to eat the other half of a steer, so I started considering alternatives. Besides, there's always somebody in those hotels assigned to watch the band, and I just knew someone would rat me out when I tried to drag my steer up to the fourth floor. I called room service. The lady who answered when I called the room service number on the phone had either just started working there minutes before I called or had perfected a deniability telephone process that even a recording of our conversation could not challenge. By the time I hung up, I had no idea if or when anything was coming, and was overwhelmed by a feeling of gratitude for having been allowed to thank her. I had been reading specific orders from the menu, but may as well have been reading the yellow pages backwards in Latin. The one thing I remembered her saying quite often was, "Y'all sure talk funny, huh?" She offered to read my order back to me, but I told her I was in my 30s and didn't think I had that long to live. There was a slight possibility that the band had arrived while I'd been at the TV studio, but I doubted it. My brother Dennis, who was road manager by that time, had been a passenger in one of the two vehicles that were rented that morning to transport the band while I flew down. There had been a four-door Chevy and a station wagon, eight musicians, and a road manager leaving Jefferson City, Missouri for 6 or 7 hours with a meal and under the speed limit. I had a room list from the desk clerk and dialed my brother's room, but didn't get him. I put a ball game on my hotel room TV set. Room service arrived. I had no way of confirming or denying if it was either what I ordered or what I wanted, but by the time it got there, I was hungry enough to eat the tray the brother brought it in on. I do remember giving the brother a lot of money, possibly all I had in my pocket, thanking him for bringing whatever it was, and saw that it was a plate from Walmart and a plastic knife and fork. People in Texas seem to have tremendous egos, no matter what part of the state they're in or what part they play in it. Their partisan perspective toward their state was probably appropriate when they were what they hadn't yet been told they were not anymore. The thing I enjoyed more than anything else about Texans was their absolute certainty about how glad everyone should be to be there, where one could be treated to a grand tour of the myths and misinformation all Texans have at their fingertips, and recite without provocation like children reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. I remember a brother in a bar asking me where I was from, and when I answered New York, he told me that Texas had become New York because that was where the biggest and the most of everything was, in Texas. It had been in New York before Texas got hold of it. Texas had got hold of was the part of the conversation I had missed. Fortunately, this almost a conversation was taking place after a show back when I was still drinking, and I wasn't unhappy about someone else using me to talk to himself. It might have been the Astrodome. I seem to have remembered that when they opened the stadium, it was called the Eighth Wonder of the World. Probably by a Texan, I decided. But hell, it could have been oil, which they had mostly run out of, or Dallas-Fort Worth, the Dallas airport, where every airline had its own terminal, or space, as in land, which it had more of than anywhere in the states except Alaska. But who the hell wanted to run around shouting, "We're number two"? The brother who'd begun this attack of the similes was continuing unabated, not making any progress toward the point, so I'd waved for another drink and continued in my own meticulous way to think of things his point might be, feeling that when I thought of it, I would know it and have no more need of his confirmation than he seemed to need of me to listen. And then it hit me. The question must have been, how do you pronounce H-O-U-S-T-O-N? That was the only New York-Houston conflict there's been since the Houston Astros and New York Mets were added to the National League together. The Mets won in 69, and New Yorkers still called it Houston, the way it was spelled. In my hotel room, the ball game on TV was over. I had not been involved enough to know who had won or even who played. I vaguely remember taking the tray and what I'd been given for dishes outside my door as though someone might want them back. I should have put them in the middle of the hall with a sign that said, "Beware, toxic waste." I could just imagine some brother zipped up in a foam rubber spacesuit and a 10-gallon hat moonwalking that bullshit down the back stairs, holding it out in front of him with some Texas-sized prongs. I called my brother's room again. No reply. Usually I could imagine, but now I was drawing a blank. I hadn't actually seen them leave Jefferson City, but I'd seen everybody that morning, which meant that no one had fallen in love and couldn't be located. No one was from Texas or Missouri, so no one had been stricken with homesickness within driving distance. In fact, everybody had been kind of anxious to get to Houston because of the TV show and all the good things I had said about Mr. Davis and Miss D, without having to make anything up. Hell, even if they'd all quit, they would have called so they could laugh in my ear. And my brother would have needed a new face and an assignment from the Witness Protection Program. And they knew me. Hell, I'd do the fucking TV show anyway. I'd just have to tell the producers I'd been abandoned. There was a Western on TV now. I couldn't believe it. It would be sort of like seeing a bunch of Chinese people coming out of a Chinese restaurant in Harlem with doggy bags and getting back on the tour bus. What else was I waiting for? Must have been a Western in Houston. It actually might have been good. I didn't see enough of it to even complain about it. I suppose it played through or played out like the ball game I couldn't recall. I can't recall the movie for an entirely different reason. During the game, I had been thinking about nothing. During the movie, I couldn't seem to find the nothing channel I'd been thinking about all through the game. I got stuck with a short loop that played over and over, then over and under, then over past under, like Malcolm's loop of the vocals on the last 3 minutes of B-movie. Something new was added, but the way back to the beginning was still there. It was never over. The band members are congregating near the ticket counter. My brother is road managing, passing out tickets that will get us to Missouri. There is foolishness between the usual suspects about the usual subjects. Their women or girls, their wives and girlfriends, their misses and miseries, and the misses they missed. Then there's your all of the above. Brady and Gordon. Sheffield and Larry Mack. Vernon James wears a brief smile and says nothing. Bags and suitcases are sliding through to a lady who is about half the size of some of the luggage. Someone slides through to help. Probably Astro flirting. And the harshest part of the loop, the over that washes over me and runs over me, the part that takes its time and then takes my time and gets closer as the images get closer, changing to a sharp, like shards of glass, stark, like a scene I can't get past, that won't pass, even when I close my eyes. It's Kenny Powell, the young drummer, with his reluctant, almost a smile. Neat, clean, without a hurry, and a couple. Adults. With him. No doubt that it's his folks, his parents. Cordial. Comfortable. ready to acknowledge the usuals, the guys they know, who know them, Brady and Gordon, Astro, then turning to me. They know me. I sort of hear Kenny's soft voice just above the clamor. Gil, these are my folks. And I hear them clearer each time. Yes, how are you? We've just come to see Ken off and to ask you to please take care of our son. And it ran again, and I saw that the movie was over. The Western was over. The airport scene in my mind started over, and I opened my eyes to look around the hotel room where the phone was ringing. It was my brother, and the details of his explanation were not lost, but were just words to me. There had been a blowout. Kenny was driving. They had spun across the median and across the highway between spurts of traffic headed in the opposite direction. They came to a rest, to a stop past the shoulder on the other side, through a break in the restraints that ran thigh-high to a point only a few feet from a drop down into a ravine. They had gotten out of the car, undamaged, but immobile, leaning like a drunk on the wheel where the tire was ripped. They sat there until Sheffield arrived on the scene. They got in, cramped and happy to be cramped, and came to Houston. 32. I had played in Houston at a place called Rockefeller's, where the guys who ran the club walked around with sidearms, show enough, 45s in holsters, like Matt Damon from Gunsmoke. On first glance, I thought having the folks who hired me provide their own armed security seemed a mite melodramatic, a little bit too Texas and Wild West for me. But knowing about an after-show robbery at the Beacon Theater on Broadway, where a producer was actually shot for the gate, gave me cause to reconsider and say to myself, hell, maybe I should be wearing a gun up in this camp too. At the very least, I couldn't say what these folks should not do. On October 31st, 1980, back in Houston to start the Hotter Than July tour, I was tired already, sweaty and exhausted from a 5-minute trudge uphill, learning as I trudged why this block-sized enclosure was called the Summit. A place called the Summit would be at the top of a fucking hill, right? I had just found a stage entrance for a venue I had never played. The places I had played in Texas on prior trips could fit into this sprawling hothouse about 10 times and still leave room for the Rockets to play their games without me getting in their way. Finally, holding a four-letter filled conversation with myself about the 100-degree temperature in this desert in fucking November, I pushed through the door marked Performer's Entrance and found myself being eyed suspiciously by a 6-gun packing guard before I heard a buzzer and was waved on through. An inner glass door with a cardboard placard taped on it saying to Performer's Dressing Room provided further direction. I hadn't made it. I was inside the Summit. I wasn't interested in a dressing room right then. At an ill-lit fork in the hallway, another handwritten message said to the main stage, so I made my way vaguely on through the maze of dimly lit corridors. I dragged on cautiously, following signs that indicated I was headed toward the arena floor. Suddenly, after feeling that I might have been better off calling AAA for a suggested route, I turned into the lights of the vast arena, as busy as a small town. Men and women in work clothes were pulling metal folding chairs off of racks that might have once carried station wagons cross-country. The men had developed a style of flipping the seats open from their rigid, straight-backed status to a position where behinds built with uniquely flexible angles could survive for 3 or 4 hours. I had on my rose-colored prescription lenses and was scanning all the rows of fabric-covered fold-ups bolted to the floor in ascending stages that merged in a design of discomfort. I put my personal attaché case down for a minute. It was an impressive sight. Choreographed chaos on a Roman scale. But suddenly, somebody called my name. Well, not exactly my name, but somebody's name for me. The name he always used, my astrological sign. So I knew who it was. It was somebody who shouldn't have seen me come in. How's that? The call for me rang out again, echoing around in the cavernous hall. Aries. I scanned the upper reaches of the place looking for Stevie Wonder. And there he was, in a seat near the top row in the bowl-shaped theater. He was leaning forward in my direction from the sound booth. Alone. There was no mistaking him. His cornrows were surrounded with a soft suede cover. Large, dark sunglasses hid most of the top half of his face, and a huge Joker's grin furnished the lower half. He had a wireless mic in his hand and, again with the grin, was saying, "Come on up here, Aries." I started for the stairs, still scanning. Now I could see there was an engineer-type person in the booth, but his back was turned to Stevie, and I didn't believe I knew the man anyway, or that he had identified me. He hadn't. But since I hadn't figured it out yet, and Stevie was having such a good time messing with my head, "How you been, man?" I said as I climbed. "If you saw me get out of that cab from the airport, you should have helped me pay for it." "We felt your vibes, Aries," Stevie said, and he laughed out loud, shook his head, and held his 100-watt smile. I was close enough now to see that the headset Stevie was wearing was not yesterday's setup. This one had an almost invisible wire around his head with a tiny mic attached to the earphones. It was supposed to be for communication with other sound and light stations around the bowl, but this one was modified and made Stevie look like a switchboard operator from outer space. No matter what Stevie said, I knew his brother Calvin was in here somewhere with the same type of headset. If there was anybody as likely as Stevie to joke around in a billion-dollar arena with $1 million worth of sound equipment, it was Calvin. Wherever Calvin was, a good time and a lot of laughs were always near. I sat in the same row with Stevie, a couple of seats away, and watched the workmen and women constructing the stage set and aligning the floor seats on the canvas that covered the basketball court. They were roping off the first 5 rows, which would probably be reserved for the VIP guests and press. There were also men in blue coveralls stacking speakers 3 deep in front of the stage, tying up the massive maroon curtain, bolting it to fasteners on the apron constructed for just that purpose. A complete sound team was now on stage, clearing space for the drum risers. Stevie's band members were appearing here and there. The work area was filling up. Electricians, light technicians, security personnel, supplementary sound amplifiers, monitors, speakers and cables, side fills, multicolored gels directed at points along the stage floor where band members would stand and sit during their performances were being placed according to stage diagrams on clipboards. I saw Malcolm Cecil wander in from backstage, opening sound crates and jotting down the contents on a thick pad. Malcolm would be handling the audience sound for me on the first few nights, while my regular engineer, Dave McLean, handled my onstage monitors for the band. I was thinking that most audience members would be glad they hadn't seen any of this preparation. It was too much like the work they wanted to leave behind when they bought tickets for a night of relaxation. Several of the sound crew wore jumpsuits with Britannia Row stenciled on the back. There had been a rumor that Stevie had hired the UK's biggest road production company to handle this tour. They had just completed the Pink Floyd tour for the group's hit album, The Wall, which meant that not only could they supervise and coordinate sound and light support for this show, the crew could also construct a wall between the onstage performers and their audience over the course of a 2.5-hour show. Great. If I found out I needed a wall. "How you been, Aries?" Stevie asked. He and I had an astrologer in common, a DC lady named Amali, who sent me a monthly lunar return reading when I was not in the city. She had told me about Stevie's interest in the stars, and his own production company was called Black Bull. I was used to him hailing me with Aries, though I did not call him Taurus. About 5 years before, Amali had ignited my interest in astrology. She had been doing a reading for Norris Little, also known as Brute, and I had wandered to the threshold of a back room they had commandeered at a party. All I'd wanted to know was whether or not Brute still needed a ride home before I made my exit. Without even looking up or really acknowledging my presence, Amali had said, "You don't know anything about this, do you, Aries?" I had to admit I didn't know Sydney Omar from Sydney, Australia. "Well, you just wait right there until I finish this and I'll get to you," she said. She went on with her talk to Brute. I was still trying to figure out how she knew I was an Aries and how she'd known I was standing in the carpeted doorway without turning around. I was still looking for the mirror on the opposite wall that had given me away when she got up from her seat, leaving a befuddled Brute contemplating his life. When she turned and walked over to me, I was more impressed and even less inclined to think Zodiac. She was short and petite, light caramel with huge liquid eyes. There was a hint of mischief lurking just behind her attempt to be all business. She picked up a little notebook and pen. "My name is I know what your name is," she said. "What I need to know is your place of birth, day of birth, and time of birth." "I can give you all that," I agreed slowly. "But I'm not trying. Look," she indicated impatiently, "I ordinarily charge $50 a piece for these workups, but what I'll do for you is a birth chart and a lunar return chart, and it will mention specific days and events. If none of these things come about, you owe me nothing." I hate it when people call me out like that. When you're put in such a position that you really look like a jackass if you don't go along with it, how can you refuse $100 worth of service for free? "Hell, you don't believe it, right? Okay, fine. You're in a win-win situation. If you're right, you win. If she's right, you win because you learned something." I told her, "Born in Chicago, April 1, 1949, at 11:20 a.m. No matter, there was no way she resembled a shriveled gypsy with a crystal ball. "How long does it take to be an expert in this?" I asked without sarcasm. "I don't know," she said. "I've been at it for 8 years and I'm a novice." I had more confidence in her immediately. Who's that old geezer? I was jerked back to the summit on a string. The Britannia Row booth engineer had come out of the sound cage and was standing behind our row between me and Stevie. He was pointing accusingly at the stage floor, and a gentle white-haired soul with slightly bent posture, dressed in jeans and opening and closing crates of equipment, jotting and scribbling what he saw on a wrinkled notepad. "That's Malcolm Cecil," I said, leaning back to look the engineer guy over. He was short, muscular in the way equipment men will be, wore glasses, was pale from his constant time indoors, and wore a sour expression on his face. "I got Cecil to do sound for me a couple of nights," I said to Stevie. "You don't mind, do you, man?" Stevie didn't mind. I knew that he had worked with Malcolm in L.A. on more or less solo LPs they had done a half a dozen years ago, and that they then parted company under circumstances I did not understand. To the engineer, I said, "He's just taking stock." I was surprised with the energy of his displeasure. "I'll take his stock," the Brit said with vehemence. I laughed. "I wouldn't do that if I were you," I said. "In fact, I wouldn't do that if you were me." He said something that sounded like a negative assessment of Tureans. "Bullshit," he snorted, walking away. "That old geezer." Calvin had joined us in the back row. Sure enough, he had a copy of the communication hookup Stevie had been wearing and a smirk on his face. "That was good," I told him. That was all I needed to hear. As if I didn't have a problem already, now I gotta worry about Calvin playing detective and telling on me. I gestured toward the sound man. Somebody better tell him to forget about messing with Malcolm. It was easy to underestimate Malcolm. His shock of white hair and bent physique from years of tilting forward over soundboards could grant you the right to feel that the man lived a turtle's life and never peeked out of darkened studios and had all the physical potential of a stick of furniture. That would be another one of those conclusions I mentioned. It went with, "Yeah, we got a pool," hearing the running approach and crash and adding, "But there ain't no water in it." "Who's this big dude coming?" I asked Calvin. "That's Grayer," Calvin said. We were joined by a suitably casual but exceedingly large brother in a pea coat, a sports shirt open at the throat, and well-worn jeans. He had a light brown complexion, round face, a big head with a lot of hair, and an expression when he looked at me that said he had seen one of my species before under a microscope. He had a little square over his breast pocket that said stage manager. That meant he was the man responsible for the clock and keeping shows on schedule. Not so much when you got on stage as when you got off. I agreed to be on by 8:05 p.m. each night and to hit my last note no later than 9:05. That would give the humpers and stage muscle 25 to 30 minutes to change the sets for Wonderlove and Stevie. Stevie's set would run the clock out, but at 11:30 or so, he would call for backup to do his last two numbers, Master Blaster, the reggae-flavored tune that included the line that was the title of his new LP, and Happy Birthday, his tribute to Dr. King. Grayer must have been 6'6", and he looked as though his sense of humor had been baked off him somewhere outside. I could picture him striding around the backstage area most nights with a cinematic scowl on his face. That was for show. Grayer turned out to have a sense of humor that was approximately his size, but he was also willing to go a round or two with the next person holding a conflicting opinion if their opinion meant something. Big Jim, as I learned to call him, was from Boulder, Colorado, and a fan of mine. It turned out that Grayer was wearing such a hard-assed attitude when we met because he had heard that the Midnight Band of mine had a reputation as somewhat unpredictable with regard to the clock. That had worried the people producing the shows, worrying about us starting and stopping on time. I thought that was funny as hell, knowing that Bob Marley and the Wailers were coming in after 2 weeks. Them brothers don't start rolling their joints until they're 10 minutes late, I told Grayer. I'll be around an hour in advance. I meant that. It lasted for about 24 hours. That first night, Stevie was a clown on stage, a ham, a performer, not old, but old school. Maybe schooled by Smokey Robinson himself on how to work a crowd, how to pace a show, how to stretch a song out and get the audience into a call and response sing-along. He also had a fondness for life on the edge, literally, especially the edge of the stage. He scared the shit out of me the first time we were out there on stage together for Master Blaster and Happy Birthday. I went over and joined Stevie behind his bank of assorted keyboards at center stage. Stevie sang the verses and I tried to harmonize on the choruses, more or less singing along in neutral, trying to do no harm. After the verses were done, the two of us went on patrol. He placed one hand on my shoulder and we walked the perimeter of the stage, giving fans on the side and behind the stage a chance to say, "I love you, Stevie." It was fun, singing about a good time and having one, slowly strolling around, waving to hundreds of smiling faces while thousands more clapped in rhythm. All of that was cool. It wasn't the takeoff that got me nervous. It was the landing when we got back to home base by the keyboards. The vibes were positive and love was truly in the air, and it seemed to embolden Stevie out there. He started creeping forward, moving back out toward the edge of the stage. I tried to hold his arm, but we were clearly not on the same page. Finally, still smiling, Stevie started moving back away from the edge, and I felt like dialing 911 because I just about had a heart attack. Context of white supremacy. That is the first audio segment. We'll pick up on chapter 33. When we come back, second audio segment, chapter 33. Context of white supremacy. If you have comments, observations, questions, things that stood out from the first portion of the reading, feel free to dial in the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you would like to join us but you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, tiny.com/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.com/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You should see the link. It'll say free VOPE line. Click that link. When you click it, it'll open a small window, small new window on your screen. Look on the top line. It's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button on the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. It's the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. When you do so, you should hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. Click 1. I'll see your hand on the screen and we can get you on the line. Again, remind folks, we should be done next week. This book will conclude. So our final thoughts, major themes from the book, what stood out, if we learned anything, kind of be getting that together as we're about to wrap up Gil Scott Heron's autobiography. With that, folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, if you have comments, observations, questions you would like to share, lines should be open. Feel free.
Yes, Rab here.
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers. Listen, I enjoyed the reading this time. I'll start with, he mentioned Barbara Walters, and she was interviewing Stevie Wonder, a suspected racist, Barbara Walters. Well, we can just say racist, because she practiced racism on Senator Brooke. Had an affair that she admitted in a book. but says she was beating up. She's the queen bee of beating people up. You know, and we can take that beating people up as practicing racism, especially when she's interviewing non-white individuals. By now, he and Brian Jackson had separated. I guess the Midnight Band broke up around March 1980. Now, he's been invited, I guess, to join Stevie Wonder's Hotter Than July tour. I was wondering what probably happened that broke them up, or, you know, why Brian decided to go another way. But these bands break up all the time, and but I think we can see a pattern here with Gil, because at the bottom of the page, he was saying, as far as I was concerned, I was looking at found money. I was looking like our folks would have a happy Thanksgiving and we could work on a Merry Christmas late. You know, to say something like that, you know, I guess, you know, if you're still participating, you know, with these holidays, holidays, like they're saying, then how conscious are you? I mean, he's making these songs that's in protest, but then he's amplifying these holidays. But I want to mention the two authors that he was on the show with, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, John Killens and John A. Williams. They were both great black novelists. And briefly mentioned, he had composed a song, Jose Campos Torres, which was, I guess, he was a young service person, a Vietnam area veteran. You know, he had served a tour in Vietnam. He came back. It was Cinco de Mayo. He was Mexican-American. And that Cinco de Mayo was his last Cinco de Mayo, because four racist cops beat him up and ended up throwing him off of a cliff, and they found his body floating 3 days later. So he made a point. And then that was a composition of Morning Thoughts from Vernon James. So some of his band members were still with him. It looked like Brian Jackson just left. And then that episode when he was in the hotel where he put a ball game on and he didn't know who was playing, what happened at the end of the game. I suspect that, you know, he may have been inebriated because he was saying something about drinking in there. And I was just thinking how bad it would have been if his brother and other band members were killed on the highway on their way to Houston, and he was sitting up there inebriated. I think sobriety would be best, especially in Jose Campos Torres case and Gil's case. And last, I'll mention Malcolm Cecil. I guess he was a sound engineer, but he was part of UK's biggest road production company. And when he started talking about how Calvin would joke around with everybody, he gave a metaphor that said somebody ought to tell Calvin that messing with Malcolm Cecil would be like, I guess, people saying, yeah, we got a pool, hearing the running and approach and crash, and adding, but there ain't no water in it. So, you know, I guess that metaphor was to say that Malcolm Cecil probably wasn't nobody to play with. He was a British guy, white guy that was in the business. Okay, I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking a call.
Appreciate it, Mr. Demery Four. Appreciate the additional background on the song. I think a lot of Gil Scott, or this is probably true for many artists, if not all, but certainly I think for a lot of Gil Scott Heron's songs and poems, I think there's a lot, there's tends to be an extensive backstory. Like he has songs about Karen Silkwood. He has songs about Mark Essex, who we've talked about before on the program repeatedly. There's a lot that you can research and get additional information about what inspired him to, you know, even create that composition. So, yeah, great insight, Mr. Demery Four. And keep that in mind, any of the folks who listen to Scott Heron's work, kind of keep that in mind if you hear any names, topics, themes mentioned that you are not familiar with, do a little exploring. If other folks have commentary, *61. If you have a hand, thoughts you would like to share as well. Some of the things that stood out, I did look to see if I could find, like if somebody put it on YouTube or something, this interview from the 1980s with Barbara Walters and Stevie Wonder. I think Stevie Wonder is probably the upper echelon of celebrities where I think she's interviewed him a few times. I saw later interviews, but I didn't see anything that looked like it was, you know, that long, something that looked like it was more than 30 years, almost 40 years ago. Now, I didn't find anything that old. If someone can track that down, I would love to check it out. What it sounded like, Mr. Scott Heron was describing Stevie Wonder displaying quite a bit of black self-respect and how he handled himself being questioned by Barbara Walters, someone I think Mr. Demery Four touched on that, particularly when she gets to interview black people, black celebrities, well-known black people, to really enjoy being tacky and racist to make them look bad. And it seems like Stevie Wonder did a really good job of handling himself and black self-respect. Black self-respect. If anyone can find it, if we have anyone who's fortunate enough to be able to see this, and you have a thought, that would be grand. Some of the other things, let's see. that stood out. I did feel like, you know, it would have been great to get additional information about some of the things. I think we talked about that before with the guns that they were trafficking. It seemed, I think Mr. Demery Ford said the same thing about Brian Jackson departing, just to get more details. Brian Jackson has been a pretty important figure, I think, in the music and work of Gil Scott-Heron, and even in the book he was mentioned quite a few times, and his contributions and his understanding and skill with music, just to, you know, what that was all about. And same as Mr. Demery Ford said, bands, you know, happens. That's pretty regular. People leave and make up and get back together. Pretty common in the music industry. Let's see. Next up, I was a little curious about the name when it went from the Midnight Band. He had all this changeover and new group members when it went to the Amnesia Express. Just curious name for a group moving forward. I thought great point Mr. Demery Ford had about the Christmas and Thanksgiving being mentioned at the end of chapter 30, that being some sort of, I guess, metric for success, that you've made. Whites have given you ULF nickels that you can go out and buy, you know, lots of goodies. I guess for Thanksgiving, it would just be food generally. You can go buy turkey and chitlins and, you know, all the fixings to eat a whole lot of food, most of it not very good for you. And then you can, you know, get to work buying a whole lot of gifts and presents, that stuff you don't need, that will just further finance white terrorists to dominate and pillage black people. Great observations. And if anything, this is, you know, from the 80s at this point. I mean, this is, you know, he's already done Whitey on the Moon and Revolution Will Not Be Televised, you know, all this really, really gripping commentary, and he'd written The Nigger Factory. But I mean, that's why I say, I think consistently, the observation I've seen is that we drastically underestimate the power of racism, white supremacy, that even, you know, Gil Scott-Heron is still looking forward to Thanksgiving and Christmas. Just that while they are working to establish a holiday for Dr. King, still looking forward to celebrating the other already established, cemented horror days, as Dr. Kampon calls them. Great point from Mr. Demery Ford there. Moving forward to chapter 31. Oh, man, such a great appreciation. I don't know if it would qualify. Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, they're entertainers, legendary actress. Married, obviously. Ruby Dee passed in 2014, not that long ago. But the radio program that they were doing, this seems like journalism. If they're getting Gil Scott-Heron and, you know, other black artists and authors and people to come on and share their views or share their work, their commentary and what have you, that sounds like you're doing some journalism there. But I thought that was tremendous, and the respect that he had for them. The first time that he was on their program with John O'Killens and John Williams, and they had the dialogue, he talked about how kind of awestruck that he was to even be just to be a part of the dialogue, much less, you know, to be there to try to contribute or what have you. And then the fact that they had kind of kept tabs on him, Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, and then invited him back when he was down in Texas and allowed him to do a lot of his music. Just the importance, monumental importance of black journalists, even if that doesn't, if, you know, Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, if, you know, they're generally thought of as entertainers, but same vein, and he does a lot of that throughout the book. I think he had mentioned Petey Green last week, and Gary Bird, quite a few black journalists that contributed to his success as an artist and the band's success, his poetry, the whole nine. Let's see. I guess maybe that would even be a plug too, if they have those type of opportunities, local media outlets, like your local television broadcasting network or local radio network opportunities, take advantage. If you can go and you can produce media content that has counter-racist information, constructive information, particularly for victims of non-white people, sounds like that's what, you know, Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis were doing. If those opportunities still exist, maybe we can be doing the same thing. When he talks about, think we touched on this last week. Him being so humble, meeting people. I think last week they went to the Johnson Publishing Company. They produce like Ebony Jet magazine. He went there and talked about what a pleasure that was, and just meeting lots of different people. Even this week, where he talks about Miles Davis and all these different folks that he has met. The portion this week where he says he felt he was in the presence of royalty, going through all this with Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee. But he said it was similar to when he met Quincy Jones and Sidney Poitier. And yes, I did do a snicker with my cowbell in the background. But yes, moving forward. Let's see. What else stood out from Chapter 31? I thought the talk about the Texans was pretty interesting. Lots of focus on sports. I did want to also get in as well the alcohol. Super normalized. We talked about that last week, but just that's been a theme throughout the book. And I would even say that. I think I mentioned that when we read The Spook Who Sat by the Door last year, even though that's a work of fiction, that smoking and alcohol consumption is so normalized, right? Particularly on a program where I submit sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, that in that book film, Spook Who Sat by the Door, and even in Gil Scott Heron's memoir, and even a lot of his performances, it seems like, you know, you'll often see him smoking a cigarette or alcohol, references to drugs and what have you, just really, really prevalent. I think that's something we should be very cautious of, things that normalize the consumption of white toxins, poisons. That's how we should regard these substances that are not helping us replace white supremacy with justice. Let's see. Moving forward. Yeah, the whole, when his brother, when they had the tire blowout, I think that's at least the second tire blowout that we've had. In the book, I think they had a tire blowout when they were smuggling guns. That was in the interlude, I believe. There was also a tire blowout there. I don't know what type of tire checking is going on at this period of time. But I mean, these are not just a little blowout and, you know, we kind of limp over to the shoulder of the road. These are like the most dramatic Steven Spielberg like blowouts, where they're sliding across like 8 lanes of traffic, and you know, it's a miracle that, you know, they survived. But that's happened a couple times. I don't know if that maybe there should be more vehicle safety if you're going to be a victim of racism out on the road and doing all of this. And I don't know the role that alcohol played. Just as I said, it's been such a normalized thing, alcohol and or drugs, whatever it is, just because it's been so normalized, it seemed like that was kind of hinted in the crash that happened with the interlude. I don't know what was the case with his brother's accident. I guess it's just everyone should be thankful that they walked out safely and didn't have police problems as well. I mean, that could be a whole variety of trauma. Let's see. Next, I think that's it for 32. I thought that I wish this might have been one that I wish we'd got more detail, because I felt like sometimes the chapter 32 kind of bogged down on details about all these different production folks and stagehands. And it's not that these people aren't important. Obviously, you wouldn't have, you know, these great performances from all these artists. You wouldn't have all that if these folks were not doing their job, all well and dandy. But if the book is titled The Last Holiday, we are, you know, almost at the end. I think we have read more than 75% of the book. In my view, it's pretty lacking on lots of detail about what motivated this and what he thought about Dr. King. And I mean, if it's accurate that he really was not someone who was thinking a whole lot about King, Dr. King, even when he lived in Tennessee, or the fact that he used to live in Tennessee and, you know, has this connection to that state where he was assassinated. If that's true, fine. But it just, at least to me, it just doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of detail around that. It just seems like this is going to be a really, really kind of short snippet at the end, and kind of the rest of the book is dealing with a whole lot of other things that are interesting and kind of related to racism at times, sometimes more than others, but not really a whole lot of detail about the effort to get the King holiday. And it seems like for something that significant that so much time and energy had been invested in. I felt like there could have been more detail. Let's see. I also thought the concern where he talks about kind of at the end, Greer, I guess Gil, Scott Heron, and the Midnight Band, they maybe had some sort of reputation for not being on time or not being efficient with their sets, maybe staying on too long or not being there so that they could be on time to perform. I think this is I think it's a part of that racist stereotype in terms of black people always being late, and you just can't, they're not reliable unless you get out a few lashes to make them, you know, be somewhere promptly. And then too, I think specifically with entertainers, I think that's kind of a long running racist trope as well, that, you know, black musicians, black performers, you know, they're late, you know, they're going to take 5 hours. If the show is supposed to start at 10, maybe you're lucky if they get it going at midnight. I think that's kind of a long running trope as well. And even kind of said in a manner to impugn or suggest that black entertainers are not professional, kind of sounds like maybe what the reputation that Gil Scott-Heron had. And even when this is said, that's what I mean about the normalization of drugs. When he says this, and I think this is another time, I think I mentioned this last week, when he's talking about something that has nothing to do with drugs, and he'll use an analogy to make his points. Why I say we should pay attention to analogies, they reveal a lot. He uses an analogy to make his point. He'll incorporate an analogy that in some way references drugs or alcohol, like he does here. So he starts off talking about they're thinking that you all are unpredictable and you're not going to respect the clock with your being on time and getting off on time. And he says that had worried the people producing the shows, worrying about us starting and stopping on time. I thought that was funny as hell, knowing that Bob Marley and the Wailers were coming in after 2 weeks. Them brothers don't start rolling their show joints until they're 10 minutes late. I told Greer I'll be around an hour in advance. Even right there, somehow, we still end up segueing into drug use, even though he's not talking about himself, but just normalizing these narcotics and poisons that, again, have not helped us replace white supremacy with justice. Let's see if I have anything else from 32. I guess one last thing I'll get in. They were talking about the technology and Stevie Wonder playing these games. He and his brother Calvin and messing around, I guess, at the Summit in Houston. I don't even think the Summit is still. I think they tore that down. But this headset that they have, where he says it had this really small microphone up on the headset and all this technology and what have you, if that's the type of thing, because this is like 1980, right? That was the date that he said. If all this is like in the 1980 or very early 1980s, you can only imagine the type of technology that they have now, both not just for these type of jobs, but all kinds of things, the type of technology that they would have, because that seems advanced. Like, I don't think most people at that time had seen the type of headset that he's describing, with the really small microphone on it, and you can talk to somebody else and all of that. I don't think most people had seen that type of gadgetry 30, 40 years ago. So you can only imagine the type of thing that they would have now. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, the technology they procure with white power. I'll stop there. Any other folks have comments, anything that stood out that they wanted to share on the first audio segment? Not as much explicitly about racism in that segment, but again, we are winding down towards the end. So if folks have anything they want to get in, final thoughts, concluding thoughts, things that have stuck out in the narrative, feel free. Any comments folks want to get in? We'll assume folks are satisfied. All right, then. We'll go ahead and do the second audio segment, unless I see a hand or what have you. If you have additional commentary, or if you had comments that you did not get to share, something stuck out, you had a note, if you're in an area where you can't speak, jot it down. We should have time for folks to share once the second audio segment concludes. This one, the second audio segment, is a little bit longer. Not longer than the first audio segment. It's just a little bit longer than the normal 30 minutes. Just doing the same amount of time. The first segment that we read is a little shorter. This one is a little longer than normal. Again, we're picking up on chapter 33. So this is still in the middle. He's touring with Stevie Wonder. in their effort to get a federal holiday for Dr. Martin Luther King. So this is The Last Holiday, a memoir, Context of White Supremacy, authored by Gail Scott Heron. Audio segment number 2. 33. At 7:15, I still feel groggy, and the day ahead looks gray and foggy. I'm surfing from a bad case of day-old jet lag. I start to try and slow-motion drag myself into a nice wake-up shower where I would like to spend an hour. But the clock is ticking, so as I get in it, I'm thinking more about 10 good minutes. But just as the water decides to get hot, someone at my door gives a loud double knock. And I'm thinking the last thing that I need right then is to give up the shower to let room service in. So one handing a towel around my waist and gathering what's left on my own stork-like grace, I head for the door while I'm still soaking wet and focusing on how the coffee I'll get will hit the right spot and somehow make it clear what the hell's going on. What am I doing here? Here was the hell of this business. For stretches at a time, your schedule could be as bare as a dressing room refrigerator 10 minutes after keg leg decided it was time to load up and hat up, at which point he transferred all extra beer, juice, and sodas to a cooler on the bus or the back of the truck. Then, quicker than you could say, "What the fuck is going on?" your life was an avalanche of things you didn't have time to do, and it wasn't your life anymore. And it made no difference how long you had known the tour would be starting on a particular date and how much time you had to prepare so that you wouldn't be rushed. You didn't get everything done, and you were rushed. Naturally, it wasn't all your fault. To be brutally dishonest and childishly unwilling to accept responsibility for personal oversights and overwork, none of it was your fault. After all, between your office and the record company and the booking agent and promoter's office and your band rehearsals, your time was eaten up like goldfish in a bowl with jaws. There is a certain element of going on a concert tour that must be similar to giving birth. In a creative writing course I taught at Federal City College, I had asked that my students write about an experience they had gone through that they could recall vividly and in detail. One young woman chose to describe the 10 hours she had spent in labor when her first child was born. After hearing her read, one of the first questions from the class was, "How many children do you have?" She said, 4. The following question was, "If the first experience was as disagreeable as you wrote, why would you have more children?" And she said, "Somehow you forgot how bad it was." For me, going on tour was like that. Every time I had a 7 a.m. wake-up call after a collapse at any time past 2 and was looking bleary-eyed at 7 hours or so on the highway, there's a tendency to wonder, what the hell am I doing here? Like the woman in Labor Day, you know that the end of the road is not the end of the day. When you arrive at wherever, that's when you have time to go to work. So, considering the discomfort and inconvenience even when everything goes according to schedule, why would you go out? You forget. On Saturday morning, November 1st, at the Houston, Texas Holiday Inn, when I got my 7 o'clock wake-up call, I remembered. The beauty of those flash-ups, since they couldn't be called flashbacks, was that the whole gauntlet of grief was self-inflicted. I signed on for the shows. I saw where I had to be and when. I came in after 1 a.m., called the desk after 2 a.m., asked for a wake-up call at 7 a.m., and got my amnesia at about 7:05. If anything can make you unhappier than inconveniences on the road, it's probably inconveniences and not getting on the road. Like, if there's anything worse than choking down only a couple of bites of really nice-looking cheese omelets because you're going to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, it's leaving that omelet and a cinnamon roll and the rest of a pot of coffee and not going to Baton Rouge. Well, that's a little stretch, because we were going to Baton Rouge, but I hadn't needed to leave 75% of my breakfast after only 25% of my shower and getting down to the lobby half-dressed. Understand? I was not incredibly happy. I had sharpened my sarcasm on the first weekend's routing with Stevie, making sure he knew there was no shortcut to Dallas from Houston by way of Louisiana. He took the needles with his customary smile. "Who put this weekend together? Mary Feldman?" I said to him as though it hadn't already been explained. We were going from Houston to Baton Rouge to Dallas. The ride to Louisiana was obviously a few hundred miles out of the way. It was simple. The Dallas Arena was booked for Saturday, November 1st, and available Sunday, November 2nd. Tours never wanted to miss a Saturday night, and the Baton Rouge Centralplex was the closest venue of the size Stevie was looking for. Plus, with Louisiana State University located there in the state capital, there was a sellout down the street. Gotta go there. The question we had asked ourselves when we saw that rather unusual zag that should have been a zig on the tour map was, how do we go? Because clearly we had to get back the next day. So two cars were reserved at Houston's inner city airport, Hobby. If the cars had been put on hold at Houston International, we'd have been halfway to Baton Rouge when we picked them up. And they probably would have been there. At Hobby, they were not. At least both of them were not. The car that was available when we arrived at just past 8:30 was quickly filled with five band members to pick up Route 10 East just outside the airport, which left five folks for the second car that wasn't ready until nearly 10 a.m. By that time, Malcolm Cecil, the house engineer on these gigs, was about to start pulling out some of his rather substantial head of hair. What had been a schedule with a good hour and a half of room in reserve got tight when the car wasn't ready. When Malcolm finally pulled up in the vehicle, I climbed into the shotgun seat and immediately fell asleep. I was surprised to wake up 20 or so minutes later, still parked in the terminal lot. Malcolm had lost his usual smile, or thrown it away. The car was ready. Four of the remaining five of us were there, but what Malcolm wanted to know was where the hell was Ed Brady? I knew where, and after weaving my way back through the terminal building, sure enough, I found him. Bent over what was then a fairly new form of video game called Space Invaders, Brady could kill a couple of hours in front of the ever-advancing electronic invaders without pause. Shortly thereafter, we were off to lose Anna, but by now, Malcolm's hour-and-a-half window had been slammed on our fingers by Avis and Space Invaders. We fretted and slept and slept and fretted. Up front, Malcolm and I were constantly recalculating our distance and possibilities. It was kind of ironic because in Houston, the only exchange between me and Grayer, Stevie's stage manager, had been about my group playing on time. At the speed Malcolm was driving, nearly 75 miles per hour when space opened up, we were figuring a razor-thin margin, like out of the car and onto the stage. But while Malcolm could do 75 in wide-open Texas, we weren't in Louisiana long before the flashing lights were right in our trunk. As he pulled over onto the shoulder, Malcolm told us very seriously, "Don't say a word, guys." While feigning sleep, I caught a glimpse of a Louisiana State Trooper's red stager profile as he sauntered up on us with his notebook in his hands. Malcolm's hands were full, too, and when he rolled down his window, he threw the whole thing, both hands full, into the air. Right after that, he was giving an Oscar-winning performance. I didn't catch the whole speech because I was biting my lip and burying my face in my hat. The Queen had less of a British accent. Before collecting the credentials he had deliberately dumped, Malcolm had adapted a tone and attitude that he had added to thorough frustration and criticism of American treatment of its visitors. How in the hell was he supposed to cope with delays from car rentals, time-wasting directions, etc., when all he was trying to do was get the African boxing team he was in charge of to the Centroplex on time? Rod Stager might have had it written into his contract that he be supplied with a dictionary or an interpreter. Our Rod Stager had neither. And holding Malcolm's driver's license limply in his hand, he wobbled back to his cruiser. He returned with a bit more confidence. "I'm sorry about all y'all's problems," he said respectfully to Malcolm. "If y'all can just pull in behind me, we'll get you to the Centroplex." With lights flashing and sirens wailing, we made it on time. Later that night, we found out that Bob Marley wasn't just resting up from his road trip with the Commodores. He was sick and had entered Sloan Kettering Clinic. I knew what that meant. Cancer. Bob Marley had cancer. Or, to be honest, cancer had Bob Marley. I talked about it with Stevie. He was worried and upset. I was told to keep the news a secret, but naturally there were too many people on the inside of the circle and the rumor mill was going full blast. The promotion was being handled by Dick Gregory Productions, and they had to have some information about who they were supposed to be producing. That, plus there was pressure being applied by Stevie's record company, Motown. If Bob wasn't going to do the tour, what about one of their new rock and rollers? They would give the tour more support, buy more spots for radio, and more space in newspapers. I had been totally honest when I spoke with Stevie on the question of doing the whole tour. Yes, I was interested. No, I didn't think I would have much trouble rearranging my dates. And yes, my new album, Real Eyes, was due out around Thanksgiving. But no, my label could not be counted on to do a lot of advertising before it was released. If Stevie was worried about the promotion money that would have been contributed to pump up Bob and the Wailers, well, maybe he'd better go with the Rockers. Stevie disagreed. He confirmed in Dallas on November 2, 1980, that he would continue for the duration of Hotter Than July through the rally in D.C. and on into February 1981, and now my staff were busy in New York and D.C. trying to rearrange the appearances I was canceling in order to do Stevie's entire tour. 34. There were a couple of places that were cool to play because they were hotels and your room was next door or upstairs. On Peachtree Street in Atlanta, I was right upstairs, but by the time I got there after two shows at the Agora, previously scheduled without Stevie on November 4th, 1980, Ronald Reagan was the president. It was not supposed to raise an eyebrow. living in the D.C. area, I'd read the papers and listened to the radio and TV quoting polls that all predicted his victory. But the reality of it was still something of a shock, like a brief contact with an open circuit. It was an occasion to stay up a little when, after being hoisted to my room by a creaking elevator, I found myself watching the President of the United States of America playing second banana to a monkey. Ted Turner's Atlanta Superstation was doing all-night monkey shines, playing one of Reagan's movies with the monkey Bonzo. Bonzo Goes to College, I think it was. Anyway, one of the flicks where the monkey had all the best lines and all the laughs. There was something unsettling about watching the President of the United States holding hands with and talking to a monkey. It was nearly 1 a.m., but I called Virginia and spoke to my wife. Baby Gia was asleep, gaining pounds and inches daily. Brenda was sleepy and on her way to bed. Everything was good there. We would see each other in 2 days, and they were going with me to Montreal on Saturday. We decided to discuss the details when we were both awake. But before she hung up, she read my mind and said, "Oh yeah, isn't it a scream? He really won." It was a scream, all right. Some people were screaming now, and the rest would probably have to take a number because we'd all be screaming sooner or later. I was rolling a joint and being relieved that he had not won by one vote because I made no arrangements for an absentee ballot. It was Iran, of course, more than anything else, that I felt defeated Jimmy Carter. The fact that Americans had basically been taken prisoner, held as hostages in the embassy in Tehran for months, and President Carter had been unable to get them out either by negotiation or helicopter invasion. Evidently, when Carter had vainly ordered military helicopters across the desert, he forgot to tell the Syracuse and other sandmen to lay down on their jobs, and the furious winds caused a collision between the American air vehicles, which canceled the raid. The whole fucking situation had been bizarre, starting with Carter's campaign promises to stop the supply of military support to certain world leaders, including the Shah of Iran, but he found out after the election that the deal was set in concrete and couldn't be stopped at least until the Iranians insisted on the departure of the Shah and the arrival of the venerable Ayatollah from France. The pictures from Iran of his arrival, with what looked like a million people marching and whipping themselves, was something I'd not likely soon forget. The Shah had been accepted in Egypt, and aside from his bank accounts, he was carrying a clear message from the new leader of his country: do not go to the United States. Some 25 years passed in 1954, the Shah's father had been chased out of Iran and went to the United States. 8 months later, there had been a counter-coup that put the elder Pahlavi back in the castle. The Ayatollah had not forgotten 1954, and when his directions were ignored and the Shah arrived in the States allegedly for cancer treatment, the U.S. Embassy was surrounded and the 50 people inside became virtual prisoners to be held there until the new government was stabilized. Later the same week, the blacks inside the embassy were released and told they were free to come home. All except one, the radio operator, accepted the offer. So I imagined 4 dozen people sitting around in there listening to the radio. The seizure of the embassy started a slide in Jimmy Carter's popularity, forcing a man who would rather not be threatening to okay the plan hatched by the people whose job it was to hatch crazy shit. Another movie with Ronnie and the monkey came on. Americans had a thing about animals relating to people on a human level. There was a talking mule, Mr. Ed, and a TV show with a dog who was smarter than its owners. There was less than hidden meaning in the choice of Reagan movies being shown. Message movies, an idea whose time had just shown up. What I was thinking was that America had just voted to make Stevie's job harder than a long shot. Most presidents were good for two terms, unless some disaster took place during their first term. What happened at the embassy in Iran was essentially not Jimmy Carter's fault. And as far as one could see, there was nothing that Reagan could do about it. The failed rescue attempt was not Carter's fault either, but was seen as his failure. His only hope had been for the workers there to be released before the election. Otherwise, he could have been running against a man with one leg and he would have still looked like a jackass in the Kentucky Derby. So the voters elected another jackass instead. Great. I had to take the Republican victory as another obstacle for Stevie. And since I was now signing up for the remainder of the tour, 40-odd dates that would last another 4 months, I was set back too. I would have liked to be down the hall with the band talking about the show. We had sounded pretty good in the club that night. I always felt better in smaller venues where we were closer to the crowd. But I was going out first thing in the morning, so I couldn't afford any monkey business. You dig? I was scheduled for a solo performance of poetry and music on the campus of Kent State University on November 5th. I was in rare form telling a mixed audience of students, faculty, members, administrators, and non-campus residents of the town that Ronald Reagan had been a political cast member since the 1960s. In fact, there had been several Californians from places like Santa Rita who had wanted him cast aside. It was unbelievable to me that the country as a whole had a hole in its head. Even with a good director, Reagan had never been anything other than nondescript. Nothing he had done in Hollywood recommended him for a position that at times called for the best actor in the world. I could claim my objection to Reagan was out of concern for the man's personal well-being. Aside from his age, I thought the man might be suffering from an inner ear problem. There was often a connection between the cochlea and one's balance, and Reagan seemed to be tilting to the right. It was apparently a problem that started in the 1950s when Reagan had been a Democrat and considered something of a liberal during the McCarthy era. As the president of the Screen Actors Guild, he was called on to defend fellow artists like David Susskind and Dalton Trumbo from the male monitoring senator from Wisconsin and his crony, Roy Cohn. As the years passed, the governor started tilting. First, he changed parties and became a Republican. Then his ideas brought him a reputation as a conservative. Finally, by the time students were locked up in a compound overnight in Santa Rita, he was labeled an ultra-conservative. That might have been an illness he contracted because of his state's proximity to Arizona, where the old guard, Barry Goldwater, was guarding the conservative doctrine. Turning conservative might have been considered a regional revamping of political posture or just a role adjustment. Whatever. By the 1970s, there was very little difference between himself and Attila the Hun. The problem now, as I saw it, was how far was too far to the right. And as unfamiliar as East Coast voters were with the specifics of a West Coast governor's political positions, there should have been enough ex-hippies in America to render Ron's run null and void. But it was not his Hollywood that fanned my flames. It was that, as president, he would choose justices for the Supreme Court. The audience at Kent State that November night was the kind I enjoyed. Folks who were aware of current events, were quick to pick up on my use of the California State Guard language, my facility for phrasing, my dissection of diction, even my most outrageous puns were taken in fun. Politics was not my favorite topic on Poetry Stops or in life. As a rule, heaping helpings of political opinions were a quick way to either bore people to death or become their least favorite poet. But if you were alive on the planet Earth and black, particularly a black American, in the most awkward and uncomfortable position imaginable, that of a certified tax-paying citizen with roots in the land around you that went back 300 years, you still got the short end of every stick except the nightstick, and there was damn near no way you could not have political pressure on you and therefore have political opinions. You were the odd man out. I told my laughing group that I felt another poem coming on and skewered the political past of the ex-head of the Screen Actors Guild, the ex-ambassador, ex-governor, etc., claiming that the man had more exes than a black Muslim mosque. Somehow I had developed an extra sense, social forethought. And so many of the people, places, and things I mentioned, even my throwaway lines, became significant later. Ronald Reagan was a good example. Back in 1974, in H2O Gate Blues, I'd identified Reagan, then an ex-governor of California, as part of America's new wave of leaders. I told the Kent State audience I was half and half about the Republican victory. Personally, as a citizen, I was sorry as hell, but as far as my career was concerned, it was great. I didn't want to constantly be caught trying to make a fool out of the president. I wanted a man who could do that for himself. A man like Nixon. A man like Gerald Ford, whom I dubbed Oatmeal Man in 1975 in We Beg Your Pardon, off the first minute. Of a new day, Biden could spend 25 years in Congress and nobody ever heard of him has got to be Oatmeal Man. Of course, I'd heard of Ford and had not thought the career congressman from Michigan would provide any good material. The man had never given anyone a clue that he might even have a personality. But he did have a knack for inadvertent physical comedy. There were pictures of him as a college football player in the era of leather helmets. He once tripped and tumbled all the way down the stairs of the presidential plane, Air Force One. That inspired the song called Don't Just Do Something, Stand There. And he was good for the occasional malapropism. Like when he was asked during an interview with a sports announcer at the baseball All-Star game whether he stayed current with the game, and he replied, "Oh, I managed to see a few games on the radio." And now I had Reagan. Right on. By the end of February 1981, I had completed 80% of B-Movie, my most seriously hilarious political tirade. Leaving Kent State that night, though, I had to admit that my full attention hadn't been on the crowd. I was doing a concert on the very spot where the peace movement had been shifted into overdrive by the shooting of four demonstrators by the National Guard. What a bitch of a year that had been. And now I was off to rejoin my band and continue to support Stevie on the Hotter Than July tour. 35. Montreal, November 7, 1980. I had no choice aside from moving quick. An ex-country hick whose image was city slick. The last one they would ever picked when I was in school doing my weekend stick. Compared to my classmates, I couldn't sing a lick. And though record store windows, when they saw my flick on the cover of an LP, they wished for a brick. Because it wasn't just out there, it was actually a hit. And what they were wondering was what made me tick. It was that in spite of themselves, they could all feel it. In reality, I was heading for work in the back of a cab. I was changing my shirt. My Mickey Mouse was saying it was 5 to 8, so theoretically, I was already late. Next to me on the back seat were my daughter and my wife, and I'd probably say never been happier in my life. Light rain was falling on the Montreal streets, and I slipped on my shoes and leaned back in the seat as we pulled up to the Forum where the Canadians played. Tonight, Stevie Wonder, the marquee, proudly displayed, but not a word about me or my Amnesia Express, but I was feeling too good to start getting depressed. It was only 4 days since I had found out for sure that Stevie wanted me opening the rest of the tour. The news of Bob Marley's illness was a hell of a blow, I thought, and the 8 o'clock news came on the radio. It looked like a sellout, though. The weather was damp, and fortunately, no cars blocked the underground ramp. As the cab took the curves beneath the old hockey rink, I was lighting a Viceroy and still trying to think of how Hartford had sounded and the tunes we should play, made mental notes of the order, and felt it was okay. Kegleg, my man, stood near the security line, because I never had ID and couldn't get in sometimes. I was carrying Gia as we moved down the hall, and I nodded and smiled as I heard my name called. Things were getting familiar, and I was finding my niche, but I didn't want to give producers any reason to bitch. I told my brother to get the band ready at 8 o'clock, and it was damn near 10 after I moved into my spot. James Greer gave me a smile and tapped his Mickey Mouse. The lights went down, and the crowd perked up because I was finally in the house. I was a late afternoon arrival in Boston, having gone with the wife and daughter back to Virginia between dates, which was why I didn't know anything at all about the conflict, confrontation, and finally, conflagration at the hotel the night before. It was just as well, because I must admit, my first thought when I was asked whether I'd heard about it was, no, but I damn well should have. I had naturally thought of Kegleg and my brother Dennis. That was a hell of a thing, wasn't it? Kegleg, having been named Dennis at birth, made him even more pleased about finding that nickname when he was working with Dennis Herron. It was a bitch, I was told, but I moved on to my dressing room to check my roads, and then I saw Greer. Big Jim had 2 black eyes. Not having been here, I could not say what took place. And not having spoken to Greer personally about the incident, I could not say what an eyewitness reported. And though I heard in detail what at times seemed to exceed what an eyewitness could have witnessed with only 2 eyes, I could only say there seemed to have been a difference of opinions over the 2 days, and it appeared that one of those differing points of view had been defended by James Greer, the manager of the stage, time on stage, and based on the veracity of his tenacity against a quoted number of simultaneous opponents kicking ass. The opposing points of view were said to have been held by an erratically shifting number of hotel security guards and a gentleman whose evening was looking like it might be written up as if his job had been to escort a young lady to the bar for Mr. Greer. Whatever the ultimate number of participants holding the perspective counter to Greer's, Stevie Wonder was unhappy, and he made his dissatisfaction about Boston's image as a cultural phenomenon, a legend in its own mind, a leading battleground against busing, a place of prejudice and bigotry only Jim Rice of the Red Sox could truly describe day by frustrating day. In the middle of his 2 hours, when he was left on the stage alone to do Lately and Ribbon in the Sky, Stevie started talking. And if there was ever any doubt about how perceptive he was, about how well a man could piece together his feelings from pictures drawn for him, how completely he was able to read the tenor of a time, the climate of an area, the tension-soaked atmosphere of a city, those doubts would have been erased in 6 or 7 heart-stopping, pen-dropping minutes when the Boston Garden was like the sound of 15,000 people who had just inhaled. There wasn't even the sound of anyone breathing as the brother spoke. You would remember not the words, but how Boston felt, like it had been read from stones dotted with Braille. 36. By 1980, I was an old hand at playing Madison Square Garden. If I had still been living in New York, I could have gone through a yawn or two on my second night there with Stevie. New Yorkers had a shield of cool oblivion and paid little attention to the Garden, the Empire State Building, and even the Statue of Liberty. Instead, there were millions of New Yorkers who had never visited any of those landmarks and knew only that the Garden was down near Times Square and that you played ball there. Only the most literate music fans would mention that Madison Square Garden was also a concert venue, and even they would have to say also a concert venue, indicating that was not its primary function, sort of like why there were so few hockey games at Carnegie Hall. I might have been losing my arenaphobic attitude by that point. I had now done 7 shows without an airplane hangar effect, echoes that never died. I was deciding that arenas that weren't auditoriums could be modified like cafeterias that weren't gymnasiums that I played basketball in while at Fieldston. I had already decided that my prejudice against arenas was selective, that I didn't necessarily dislike playing in front of a lot of people. In fact, the more the merrier. I was starting to compare the experience to playing on television, which I had initially hated. The idea of having my songs and my band all squeezed through a mid-range mono speaker the size of an ashtray had depressed me as much as the thought of doing a lip sync on American Bandstand or Soul Train. It had almost broken my heart to see the Temptations stumbling their way through Ain't Too Proud to Beg. There was one thing undeniably advantageous about playing in a venue like Madison Square Garden. There would be, on certain occasions, an energy generated that turned a concert into an event that gave an indoor performance an air of a festival, an aura of celebration. That was the special buzz, an inaudible hum of excitement and energy that vibrated through everyone in the place. It was running all through the Garden, in the darkened tunnels that led to the dressing rooms and the storage spaces crammed with sports equipment and other event paraphernalia. Hell, everyone, from Jumbo to Tom Thumb, or whoever P.T. Barnum had promoted, had plotted or pranced through these shadowy passages. I felt it. Beneath the bright Broadway, the traffic-choked avenues, there were other worlds that existed, worlds of magic and music and miracles. And tonight, this was to be the world of Michael Jackson. Another Jackson. Just what I needed. Thousands of fans who fantasized about being like Mike, or simply liked Mike, would get a special spectacle this evening because the Prince of Pop was already in the house and rumored to be loosening up his nearly liquid limbs in some private pocket along the passageways by the time I finished my set. He was to be a very special delivery and join me and Stevie when we closed the evening. I got to see different performers join us on stage from Houston to Hollywood. You couldn't predict the next surprise Stevie would spring on his audience as we crossed the USA and Canada. It had become so routine for rockers and high rollers to finagle their faces into the finale that there was hardly a double take from the regulars or roadies, but the Michael Jackson rumor sent some shivers through both the rulers and the riffraff. I was pleased that everyone else was pleased. From the road representatives of Dick Griffey's concerts west to certain venue venerables at the Madison Square Garden hierarchy, there was a noticeable neurosis and noise in the arena that evening. I had met Michael and a couple of his brothers before, but I couldn't say that I knew him or that he would have remembered me. I admired him, of course, since there was no way not to appreciate an artist who had sold as many records as McDonald's had sold burgers. I had been a guest of Greg Fillingame's on one sunshine-splashed afternoon at a studio in L.A., where the Jacksons were regrouping to do an album. Michael was one of the few phenoms remaining when I arrived, and Greg organized a brief introduction to folks. I was cool with that, even pleased to meet them in person. It had not been as electric as meeting Quincy Jones or Miles Davis, but I wouldn't forget that it had happened. But what did I know? Only that this youngster, with the hair falling over one eye and a voice so soft and quiet that your ears had to reach for it, was record royalty. Maybe all performers are schizophrenic, with a broader distance between their jobs and their homes, and with more space between their fame and their families. The bigger their marquee, the greater the gap. But I had never noticed that as a certainty. There was a separation, to be sure, between personalities in public and when they were relaxing off stage. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was always recognized and greeted everywhere he went. He was obviously outsized and outstanding, even while seated. In public, the brother was always serious. But there was a private person, cringing and covering up with the rest of us when the alien burst from some astronaut's chest or collapsing and holding his sides while watching an Amos and Andy video. Thanks to my access to folks who were no strangers to success, I had met a thousand names more recognizable than those who owned them. I had met Muhammad Ali on several occasions, always a bit awed by his size and agility, but relaxed by his natural warmth and humor. He kept a smile at the ready, at the corners of his mouth, and in his eyes as they searched out his surroundings. But these casual encounters with artists off-duty gave me no warning about how the electricity would elevate, how the excitement level would rise in the arena when Michael Jackson joined us on stage as the band went into the reggae rhythm of Master Blaster. He would raise the voltage. I often try to tell people how special Michael Jackson was, as though they don't know, because I myself didn't know. I thought I did, until he came out for Master Blaster at Madison Square Garden. Stevie called for the monitor man to pull the rhythm track up and with a wide grin beckoned for his special guest, someone who needed no introduction. I looked behind me as he took three steps, paused a beat, and stood straighter and taller, turning solid then as from mist to man. I don't see that well. Sometimes. He didn't just walk onto the stage. He turned solid as he came. A trick of the light. He glided past me into the spotlight. There was a surge of energy from the crowd that lifted the sound in the arena from stereo to quadraphonic, and even the temperature seemed to rise when he touched the perimeter of the spotlight. And as the crowd's suspicions were confirmed by recognition, the buzz turned into an active roar. The monitor volume was overcome, and Stevie's smile got wider, and he clapped his hands close to his chest and waited for the turn, caught the opening when it swung around again, and the house roar slid down to thunder again. When the hook arrived, it was like a huge transport landing on foam. Didn't know you would be jamming until the break of dawn. Michael and I began on the beat and on the same harmony note, but as smoothly as he had floated from the shadows to my side, his voice climbed to the next harmony note, where he seemed to cancel our collision and make himself at home again, two notes further up the scale. After another chorus with me holding the mic for Mike, I realized how prepared he was to do this and how unprepared I was to do it with him. He knew the song, all of it, the lyrics, the changes, and all the harmony parts. Hell, I hadn't got my part right until we got to Hartford. Tonight, I felt like a 6-foot mannequin clutching the base of the wireless like a giant gray ice cream cone, frozen into a position of extending my arm between us, trying to collect both of our voices. It felt like reaching for water with a butterfly net. I was committed to remaining stationary and holding the sound stick steady. Michael might have been, but even while standing still, he seemed to flow in every direction. Without a further thought, I handed him the microphone and strolled to the shadows on our side of the stage. In essence, I got to watch two wonders at once. Up close, a smiling Stevie at center stage behind his keyboard bank with his head slightly tilted in what had been my direction, and sliding in and out of the circle of soft light that usually told me where to stand, I saw this youngster bending with impossible balance, twisting the tempo around him like a thread that spins atop, and then he reversed it, twirling like a boneless ice skater. The symmetry was perfect because he was still as a statue when the foundation of the verse appeared and Stevie came in again. I was looking ahead and saying I had 30 more shows to try that to get it like Mike. Probably not.
And that will do it for the second audio segment, Context of White Supremacy. Again, we will conclude Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Holiday, next week. All done moving forward. And I believe we should be doing Frantz Fanon. I think it's Wretched of the Earth. That's the book that has the most votes. I believe I'd said Wretched of the Earth. We could also do Black Skin, White Mask. But I believe all the folks thus far have said Wretched of the Earth. But we still have ample time. We've got one more week before we wrap up Gil Scott-Heron. Folks, have commentary you would like to share, questions, observations, concluding thoughts as we, you know, prepare to move on to a new book, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last minute. If you have commentary you would like to share, if it's something you think you want to respond to, go ahead, hand up now. Let's see, the folks who have a hand up with us, Mr. Demrefour, line should be open. I'll nab other folks as I see them. Anything stand out in the second audio segment, Mr. Demrefour?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes, well, part of the reading seemed like he was covering political issues. Reagan was president at that time with his trickle-down economics, whereas it didn't trickle down to non-white people. And that incident in Iran, you know, where they were hostages and they offered to let the blacks go. And I know that in a hostage situation, if somebody say you can go, you know, you can't blame them for taking off. And I think one, the radio operator chose not to go. And I can't imagine that in another country and given the opportunity to leave and you get. Then he played at Kent State. And he said he didn't like politics, but it don't seem like he passed up an opportunity to get political, you know, with his programs. He said he liked playing to smaller, you know, more intimate surroundings, but when forced, you know, to perform, well, not forced, he knew of them, but I guess he could adjust to the larger crowds as well. He seemed to have gotten some satisfaction out of the Kent State, and then he made comments that would lead you to believe that the students at Kent State were more aware of the political going on and than I guess the ordinary citizen. I'll mute my line on that. Thanks.
Appreciate that. Mr. Demery Four, let's see, other folks, I'm going to get my comments in as well. Just other folks, if you have anything to share, feel free. Some of the things that stood out in the second portion that we read this week, this is from chapter 33, when he's talking about, I guess they got behind on their schedule, right, when they were going to go from Texas with the Stevie Wonder tour, Texas to Louisiana, and they got behind. One of the band members, Brady, was playing Space Invaders. Just reminded me, we talk about, you know, really value your time and energy. Racists, they come up with a variety of things, video games, TV shows, you name it, to waste non-white people's time. It would be totally different if there was no system of white supremacy. Fine, sit around and play Space Invaders or any other video game. Sit around and play it, you know, all day long, Pokemon Go, whatever it is. But we have problems. The way that we use our time and energy really needs to be strategically and methodically focused on solving black people's problems. Next thing that stood out. The whole scene, right, where they're like speeding through Louisiana to try to get to the Centroplex for this show, and they get stopped by an enforcement official. And Malcolm puts on this performance that he's British, right? And he's trying to get the soccer team, these African soccer players, to the Centroplex. And the officer, he falls for it and ends up escorting them so they get there on time. It reminded me of some of the controversy from earlier this year with Samuel L. Jackson and the film Get Out. And you know, our black British guys, you know, treated better and used to put down black people, that whole scene. And I've heard scenes like that before from, I was going to say that time period, but really it would be like the 50s and 60s where black people pretended to be like diplomats or, you know, a black person from another country or what have you. And they were able to fool some racists and they allowed them to do some things that they wouldn't have normally done for a Negro that was born here. Let's see. So I did think that was codified because it seemed like he knew that he was going to do that. So he was already telling them, don't say a word. Just be quiet. I got it. United Independent Codification, it seems, Gill and company, they followed orders and did not say a word. Everything worked out okay. Let's see. Continuing. Let's see. Moving. I think that was all I had for chapter 33, 34. This segment on Ronald Reagan, I found fascinating. I don't know why. I think there had been at least, I think there was one other project that I was watching archival footage of Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure in Louisiana. So we're just talking about it, New Orleans. And they were talking about George Bush, and it was so interesting hearing the way that George Bush was being discussed around the time of Katrina in 2005, hearing the way that President Reagan is being discussed in this book in the era of Donald Trump. And it just reminded me of how cyclical just the system of racism, white supremacy. You just see the same types of things over and over and over because it's just more of white supremacy. But they will have these, you know, figureheads, Ronald Reagan, Bush, Trump, where everyone can get mad and, oh my gosh, this guy's a loser. He's, you know, messing it up for everybody and we've got to get him out. And they'll, you know, do that for, sometimes they'll do that for 8 years, you know, like they did with Bush the second time around and Reagan. And I suspect, in fact, I would put money down. I think Trump is two terms. But they'll do this sort of thing and act like he is the problem. And if we could just get rid of him, everything will be great. And nothing could be further from the truth. But it was very refreshing with all of the daily hysteria about Donald Trump to read this. Oh, yeah, before him, it was that guy Reagan. Also, the commentary about the monkeys, where he talked about after he won the election. He says, it was an occasion to stay up a little when after being hoisted to my room by a creaking elevator, I found myself watching the President of the United States of America playing second banana to a monkey on this day, this week, when War for the Planet of the Apes just released. I don't remember the count, but this is, we're getting close to double digits in the Planet of the Apes film series, the system of white supremacy rampant in that series. But yeah, it just, it stood out. The whole clowning on Ronald Reagan here, and I remember a lot of that with President Bush. Certainly, I thought his commentary about Jimmy Carter and why Ronald Reagan won. We just talked about that with Coretta Scott King's autobiography, and she blamed black people. I think I remember that specifically in saying that black people didn't come out to vote, and that Jimmy Carter was, you know, had been the coolest person towards black people. I didn't seem to get that impression from Gil Scott Heron. It didn't seem like he was, you know, overjoyed with Carter. He seemed sympathetic, for lack of a better term right now, to his plight with what happened with the Iran hostage situation. But I didn't get that sense from Gil Scott Heron's analysis of this same election. Let's see. I also thought I had a chuckle when he said I was Coretta Scott King blamed black people for not voting. One of them, I guess, would be Gil Scott Heron, who confessed that he was rolling a joint and did not vote, and that he was happy Jimmy Carter didn't lose by one vote because he was smoking reefer. Sobriety would be best under the system of white supremacy. Let's see. And I heard some of that this time around as well. Donald Trump, that black people didn't vote. It was our fault. We didn't, you know, get out and do our part like we did for Obama. Let's see. I thought that was interesting. I won't get into it, but just it gave me pause when he said, when he noted white people's affinity for TV shows where the dog is smarter than the owner. It does seem like there are a lot of them. Maybe something I'll think about later. His commentary about Kent State, this reminded me a lot of many aspects of our conditioning under white supremacy in terms of us being conditioned for white identification, white acceptance. One of the ways we can get validation from white people, if we can show, hey, I like white people. I don't think of you as a racist, and I just want you to accept me, and I feel bad when you hurt. When those students were killed at Kent State, I felt bad about that. That was terrible. And this is not just a race thing, because white people are suffering too. They love that. That is, oh, we've got another one who does not understand what racism is, how it works. Great. We are going to be able to get over on them well. And it stands out because I think we just heard a lot of this in Coretta Scott King's autobiography as well, where she was talking about Kent State and the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. It seemed like it was a lot of white identification, lots and lots of white people. Reverend Reeb, Vala Luiso, it was lots and lots of white people that she was talking about, and I get some of that same sentiment hear from Gil Scott and talking about how responsive they were. I think Mr. Demery Ford just touched on that, that they got, you know, all of his jokes. And he says they were quick to pick up on my use of California State Guard language, my facility for phrasing, my dissection of diction. Even my most outrageous puns were taken in fun. Like, oh, these white people were just amazing and treated me so well. Like, very, very common. I think that is what we are. That's when you are subjected to generations of terrorism, you are conditioned to seek out and find, yes, salvation, some white people who do not treat me and call me a nigger. They are nice to me, and in fact, we can have a grand conversation. That's what we are trained, conditioned. It's logical in a system of white supremacy to see that type of behavior. Let's see. Leaving Kent State. He kind of made my point right at the end where he says, leaving Kent State that night, I had to admit that my full attention hadn't been on the crowd. I was doing a concert on the very spot where the peace movement had been shifted into overdrive by the shooting of four demonstrators by the National Guard. What a bitch of a year that had been. That's what I mean, how just this over glorification on four white people being killed. You could just pick any year and it would be a bad year for black people under the system of racism, white supremacy. And how many times do you have huge numbers of black people killed? I mean, you could just almost go to any random spot and you would, you know, be able to say that about black people. But there's such an immense value on the lives of white people. It really comes through for me in sections like that. Also wanted to make sure I got in because he has a lot of poems here. I've said before, it's no secret, I am no fan of poetry. Dr. Welsing, the late Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she said on a phone conversation with me, she said that doing a lot of rhyming, she said that that is evidence of mental illness. And I was just trying to get clarification. I didn't know if this was like her theory, like this is just her own clinical observation, or if this was just like a widespread, you know, conclusion or her theory that people held in the world of psychiatry. And she said, oh, no, this is in medical journals. You know, this is not my theory. Like, this is, you can go read about it. It's in journals and what have you. They have papers on it to just, you know, a lot of rhyming and talking in rhyme that, you know, that is generally considered or widely considered evidence of mental illness. And it sticks with me now at times like this, lots of passages of Gill's in this book opening with poems, specifically with chapter 35, where he opens with this poem about them visiting Montreal in 1980. He says, when I was in school doing my weekend stick, compared to my classmates, I couldn't sing a lick. And through record store windows, when they saw my flick on the cover of an LP, they wished for a brick because it wasn't just out there. It was actually a hit. I cracked up laughing because I think I said earlier in reading this text, he was talking about being at Lincoln University when he got his book published, and he said that, you know, he wanted to get that book so that he could go back and shove it in the face of all of his, and he went to an HBCU, all of his black classmates, so he could shove it in their face. You're like, you thought I was just some weed smoking idiot. Well, take that. He was going to shove it in their face. And it seems like that same sentiment is still there in this poem many years later in the 80s. That sentiment is still there. And I'm laughing. He's a victim of racism. I am too. I've had similar thoughts in my life. I'm laughing because Mr. Fuller does insist. He has concluded, unfortunately, this is one of the products of white supremacy where our total ambition in life, black people, our total ambition in life becomes, I am going to impress another black person. I'm going to show off to this black person what I've got, what white people have allowed me to do, how much money they've allowed me to have. I'm going to show off to this other black person and be like, you are a no good nigger. I can just tell them all. And, you know, you thought you were somebody and look what I got. Take that. Like, that ends up being what a lot of us, that's what we devote our time and energy to. And bam, right there, right there in the poem. Victims of racism, just the anti-blackness trying to do better. I also lighting a Viceroy, talked about that before. Sobriety would be best. Tobacco, the joints, the alcohol, all of the narcotics. Also in that same poem where he says, because I never had an ID, I think that's something that a lot of black people can relate to. I certainly can. My recent travails visiting the Department of Licensing, a.k.a. Department of Motor Vehicles in Washington State. Last thing I'll get in, this portion kind of towards the end. I felt this a few times. I guess this would be a significant frustration of mine in this text. There are a number of portions, like you could dump all of the poems and give a little bit more information on why Brian Jackson left, what was up with the gun smuggling, if that was what it was, with the car accident that was in the interlude, what was up with Stevie Wonder and this commentary, because it seems like Stevie Wonder is saying something about racism. I don't know if people have any thoughts on what they think was happening in this segment, but he said this is at the end of 35. He says, whatever the ultimate number of participants holding the perspective counter to Greer's, Stevie Wonder was unhappy, and he made his dissatisfaction about Boston's image as a cultural phenomenon, a legend in its own mind, a leading battleground against busing, a place of prejudice and bigotry only Jim Rice of the Red Sox could truly describe day by frustrating day. That is not clear enough to me in terms of, was this fight that happened? Because this is after the fight where, you know, there was a major conflict that he missed, and, you know, this guy, Greer, ended up with two black eyes and what have you. It just wasn't enough detail in terms of what exactly provoked all of this, and was racism a part of all this? Did Stevie Wonder end up saying something about racism in Boston specifically? To me, it was vague. And if I misread, and some other people, they read that or they heard that and you got it, help Gus T out, because it was not clear to me. And I think this sort of thing happens a lot. Woo! Totally unrelated subject matter, but last night at the book discussion on Dr. Vanessa Grubb's new book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, same exact thing. There are so many times when racism, white supremacy is what we're talking about, but people are really investing a lot of time and energy to not talk about racism. So it ends up being buckets of words, or sometimes it can just be a really vague, strange to understand sentence or bucket of verbiage, and you're just left saying, what does this mean? I don't understand. That's the feeling that I had last night at times. That's the feeling that I had with this passage here about Boston. And I guess I'll stop there. If any listeners, if you have any thoughts, if you have any clarity on that paragraph about this situation in Boston that seems like it's connected to this fight, unless I am not understanding. Excuse me, it's Big Jim. Yeah, Greer had two black eyes, and it seems like Keg Leg may have been involved. I don't know. But if people have any thoughts on the Boston situation, the portion that I just read, or if you have any other thoughts that folks want to get in before we conclude, feel free. I'll check. Any folks have any clarity on that passage that I read? You're just confused as I am. I understand. Don't see anyone. Maybe they didn't get it either. I'll have to think about it. If you listen to the archive and you hear that paragraph, if it stands out to you, if it makes sense, or, you know, if you feel like it's not vague, you got what was being said, great. You can let me know. Maybe you can send me a paragraph. Maybe you can just, you know, send me what you heard or what you thought, what made sense to you from it. But yeah, it was a little vague, and that's been my pattern when people talk, or when people are trying to not speak clearly and directly about racism.
You know, there was certain portions of the book that, you know, was not quite clear. When he mentioned something about, like, the woman in Labor Day, where at the end of the day, that it wasn't actually the end or something. You know, I got kind of lost in there, and I was thinking back in the 1980s if that may have been a movie that was out, and, you know, he was referring to that in that period of time, so that, you know, 30, 40 years later, it wouldn't, you know, mean quite as much to us now. But I also thought about that fight when that was Stevie Wonder's stage manager that ended up with two black eyes. And I could see where he would be upset about it. And then for him to actually say something during the concert, you know that that was something important that we should have been let in on, you know, what he actually said, because Stevie Wonder has a certain way of diction, you know, and saying things, you know, where he can get his thought across, but it will be elegant in a way. So, let's see, one other thing I want, when he was talking about Reagan and how he said, they asked him about if he kept up with the ball games, and he said he looked at some on the radio. You know, Reagan was, it was kind of like a running joke. You know, he'd fall asleep at his desk and eat jelly beans and all the time. And I think the guy was pretty close to 80 years old, I think, when he was elected. He made those references about his B movies. None of those movies were any good anyway. But I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
Indeed, indeed. Yes, his infamous B movies. And that was in Boston when Stevie Wonder, you know, is about to perform and actually stops to, you know, give a bit of spontaneous commentary. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, obviously, you're not going to capture everything. But I mean, this is not the era where everybody has an iPhone, right? So it's not like you got YouTube footage of this or somebody has a recording so we can get verbatim exactly what he said. But I mean, the same way that I thought he did a great job capturing the spirit of Michael Jackson's performance and how, you know, it electrified the arena that evening, I think you can still give, I think you could do a better job giving the sense of why he needed to say something and what he was talking about, particularly because it sounds like it might have had something to do with racism explicitly. And if that was connected to the fight and all that, I just, more detail, more clarity. This happens a lot where we end up doing a lot of pussyfooting when it comes to racism. And again, I guess this would be a great time to remind folks that this was published posthumously. 2012, he passed away in 2011. So, you know, who knows things that were going on with all that. Anywho, make sure folks are not waiting till the last minute. If folks are spectating, the other folks that dialed in, if folks do not have commentary, we will not go all the way to the end of the hour. If folks do not have anything that they want to add, checking through to make sure I did not miss anything. Oh, that was not Reagan who did the tumble down the plane and said the managed to see a few games on the radio. That was Ford, it looks like, making sure. Yeah, it seems like that is Ford. And he says, and then after that, now he has Reagan. So making sure we're all straightforward. Looks like, oh, the other person dialed in. Person, last four digits, 3637. Did you have a commentary you wanted to add in? 3637?
Hello, everybody. Yeah, I got a little comment. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I was able to going away from my work for a minute. I've been listening. I listened last week. I just wasn't able to comment, but I was going to tell Mr. Dimery that, yeah, that was President Gerald Ford that said that he saw the game on the radio, but you cleared that up. And he was describing Stevie Wonder with the cornrows and the glasses, the sunglasses. I remember when I was younger, and I used to listen to Stevie Wonder, the album, and he had this one album. It was so beautiful. It had this background that was blue, and then you can see he had his hair in beads, and he had on the sunglasses, and it was just an amazing cover of Stevie Wonder. But Gil Scott here on, yeah, this is a good book, but I was wondering, like you all, when are we going to get to the holiday? The book's named The Last Holiday, and I thought that he was going to be telling us more about what happened with the MLK holiday, but not really getting a little bit, but and the talking about President Reagan, it sounded like people were reacting to Reagan getting elected the same way people reacted to Trump. So that was a good comparison. And again, like you were saying, Gus, it's amazing. I don't envy it or I don't agree with it, but it seems like racism and white supremacy, just they have the same model, they have the same mold, and they stick to that mold, and they just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. And then us non-white folks, we're not catching on. And so I want us to catch on what's going on here so we can get our... so we can stabilize our minds to get this thing wrapped up. And that was my comments. And a good book, but I am excited to read Wretched of the Earth. I haven't got into any of Fanon's reading, but I was told I should, and I'm kind of late again with reading, so this would be great. But thank you for letting me comment.
Absolutely. I can get that on record now. I am not excited about Wretched of the Earth, but, you know, whatever. I thought it was significant as well. Mr. Demery, I think, brought up with the Iran hostage situation, the black people that were allowed to leave. Again, the global system of racism, white supremacy. I think people understand who, what is it Mr. Fuller, I think, says all the time? Justice is the people who need the most help get the most help. Whatever the conflict or problem is, certainly black people are not to blame. I think Mr. Fuller said that, get the children out of the way, and then, you know, we can settle whatever dispute we have. And I think even if there was one black person victim of white supremacy who chose not to exit, that might go back to same thing I was saying before about the Kent State situation and all that white validation, white acceptance, I'm going to stick in, we're all in it together type thinking, just victims. We are all victims. I do think that's very important. I think sometimes it's very easy to become just kind of locked into what's happening right now. I think sometimes it's important to pull back with perspective on all of this. It can be very easy to just fall into, oh, this person is saying something bad about Trump, whether it's a white person or a non-white person. This person is saying something bad about Trump, so right on, they must be, you know, doing something, you know, correct. That is not necessarily the case. The same thing where you had a whole lot of people jump up and say, oh my gosh, I hate, you know, George Bush. Oh my gosh, I hate Ronald Reagan. That very, very common. That does not necessarily mean that this person has black people's best interest at heart, or even that this person is not a racist. This is just someone saying what they're saying. With that, any other comments folks want to get in? We get any help with the Boston situation? Any folks have any assessment of exactly what was happening there that prompted Stevie Wonder to speak out, or if they got a better understanding of that final passage at the end of 35? No help for Gus T on that one. No help for Gus on that one. Oh, well. Folks, listen to the archives. If anyone else, you pick up any details, you get a backstory, you know somebody was there, if they have a newspaper article, I guess maybe that's something to check out. I would think if Stevie Wonder did this big benefit that, you know, the Boston Globe, the major Boston newspapers, I would think they would have had an article on all this. I will put that on my to-do list before we wrap up next week. I'll see if I can check the Boston newspaper. And anybody else, you can do that too. I know the Boston Globe, Boston Herald, not from there. Those are the two main ones that I know. But if you check the Boston newspapers, maybe they're newspaper articles. I suspect that might have been something worthy of writing down. If Stevie Wonder went to Boston and, you know, decided to stop the show and give a lecture about racism in the town, I think that would be something somebody would have written a word in the local paper about. So I will do some digging and report back if I'm able to find anything, next week as we wrap things up. If folks have a comment or word that they want to get in for the final broadcast next week, you can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, and we will include it as we wrap up. One more, and then we'll move on to Friends Benon in 2 weeks. That's it. Thanks to everyone tuning in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your time and energy. Hope folks are at least getting some additional detail, learning some, and maybe even inspired to listen to some of Gil Scott Heron's poetry music. We will be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in. We'll catch up on news, observations from the past 7 days. If folks have counter-racist suggestions or questions, observations they want to share, we will be here 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. The Global Sunday Talk on Racism will be this coming Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern, early broadcast, early in the day, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We'll be looking forward catching up with our folks across the pond. They have had a lot of interesting happens. A lot of their politicians have been getting in trouble for things that they said. Even some of their black politicians over there, MP Diane Abbott speaking out about racism. Be good to catch up, review that as well. If you have questions, if you have, if folks would prefer to do black skin, white mask, you can vote about that as well. What have you, if you need to find something in the archives, again, untiljustice@gmail.com. Particularly given the content that we read in the book this weekend, for most of the book, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Man, we had monster car, like epic, seems like tumbling car crashes here that may or may not have been related to alcohol, substance abuse. Lots of alcohol consumption, cannabis consumption, cocaine consumption, just, oh man, cigarette consumption. Sobriety would be best. Not even mentioning the financial toll of consuming all of these products and just continuing to finance race soldiers and their terrorist campaign against us. But man, it has not helped our clarity. Consuming all of these poisons has not resulted in us having the sharpest brain computers in the world so that we can solve our problems and be universal man, universal woman. That has not been the result of consuming all of these poisons. Maybe we should give it a try. I think Mr. Gil Scott Heron even said within the text at the time when he was drinking, talking about one of those narratives, the guy was talking his head off down in Houston. At that time he was drinking, it sounds like even he reached that conclusion that maybe I would be able to function a little bit better if I left this alcohol alone. I think we should all try that. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.